This is Richard Stein. This is October 2nd, 2005, and it looks like Surrender in Dreams.
I've been raised in a very impoverished situation, had a lot of childhood abuse and neglect, and so there was deep emotional pain from childhood as well. And his mother was a strict fundamentalist Southern Baptist, so he sort of grew up in that family and cultural tradition. But when he became an adolescent, he found he could think for himself, and he rejected all of that. So the summary, in a way, of the case that we'll get into in detail through the dreams is that his initiation and analysis was a surrender of his scientific, intellectual, skeptical of religion view, because these dreams of the crucifixion and the Messiah were forced on him by the unconscious. He wasn't somebody who was going to New Age workshops and trying to find a spiritual way. He was somebody who was trying to cope with very real problems of life. And it's interesting that his unconscious used the imagery of his childhood religion to bring him back to a religious attitude. So what I've done with this, and what I hope you can follow, and I hope I don't stress you too much with it, is to frame this in the context of work that Dr. Joseph Henderson has done on the archetype of initiation. How many of you are familiar with him at all, with his work? You? Dr. Joseph Henderson. Dr. Henderson is living in Marin County at 102 years old and still seeing patients. He's had a book come out on his 100th birthday called The Splendor Solus, which is a study of Renaissance alchemy. And he began his study of the archetype of initiation after reading some things in the two essays of analytic psychology, which Jung published in that period right after his break with Freud. Jung was commenting on the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece, on the mystery religions of Rome, and on the rites of baptism and communion in Christianity. And he went on to say, quote, am I still on here? Modern men have absolutely nothing to compare with this. The fact that the whole symbolism of initiation rises up clear and unmistakable in the unconscious contents is startling. The point is not whether these unconscious contents are or are not the equivalents of initiation practices. It is enough that they exist and that they work. So what Jung is saying here is that he noticed in the dreams of modern people elements of the rituals and myths of classic initiation practices. And he also noticed that many of these people had not been initiated in life in some important way. I think the classic example that Jungian analysts talk about is the puer, somebody who hasn't found his way into a committed engagement with society and with life. Last May, I had the good fortune to speak at a conference in San Francisco called the Archetype of Initiation, which honored Dr. Joseph Henderson and also celebrated the republication in paperback of his 1967 book called Thresholds of Initiation, which is really a classic on the subject. So part of what I want to do tonight is start out with a bit of theoretical material based primarily on Dr. Henderson's work and obviously following Jung as well, and use that as sort of a frame to explore this case and explore in particular a dream series that, for me anyway, is very compelling. Dr. Henderson spent years gathering case material which reflected these initiatory patterns. And in 1967, he published a book on the subject, as I mentioned, entitled Thresholds of Initiation, now republished in 2005. In this seminal work, Dr. Henderson has described the stages in a lifelong process of initiation, from the social adjustment of adolescence to the deeper spiritual awakenings of mature life. Rather than focusing solely on the traditional rites which mark the end of childhood and the beginnings of adult life, he described the archetypal processes that occur in analysis at any major turning point. These stages, represented as an internal process in dreams and fantasies of his analysands, may occur in varying sequences, and they're not meant to imply a linear stepwise development throughout the life cycle. Although conceiving of them as a sort of map of the soul's experience does have some heuristic value. At each of these stages, the initiation process is based in the more fundamental archetype of death and rebirth. The symbolic death marks the end of an outlived way of life, and it is followed by a liminal or a transitional period, which is often confusing and disorienting, which occurs in the darkness between the visible threshold. And there's a threshold of entering this, which is the death or the rite of separation in tribal rites, and then a threshold of being reintegrated into the group or into a new stage of life, which is based on the rebirth part of the archetype of death and rebirth. According to Dr. Henderson, this disorienting liminal period is the focus of existential psychology and philosophy. In classical rites, it may involve trance or mind-altering substances, and it is here that the tribal myth or the mystery religion is revealed to the initiate. The rebirth phase is vividly enacted in mythic rites and often includes scarification, circumcision, shaving bodily hair, mimetic rites that imitate the birthing process, and other signs that the person has a new identity. Parenthetically, it's occurred to me that the popularity of tattooing and piercing among young people may be an expression of the need to mark their individuality and to mark these transitions in life which our society doesn't hold. So it's a self-initiation in a way. And I think probably the more extreme form that can take is cutting, which I think at the level of a fad, cutting represents a similar marking of the body to say, I have died to some old pattern and I'm now a different person. And I think that there's plenty of research now in cutting in terms of the physical pain superseding psychic pain that's unbearable and the release of endorphins. So there are many other issues involved in cutting. I don't mean to simplify it. I want to outline for you briefly the stages of initiation which are found in Dr. Henderson's book, as we will be seeing these processes reflected in the dreams that follow. First, and there are four of these, first is what he described as the return to the mother, in which a man or a woman may figuratively return to the creative womb of the maternal unconscious for restoration and renewal. He quotes Toynbee as a historian who studied the lives of many great men who went through a period of their career being disrupted and then withdrawing, whether through a depression or a family crisis or a failure in their career. Churchill would be a famous example of that. And somebody who came back from that period to a new, mature, and far more creative period contributing to society. And that process of a return to the unconscious can occur at any time in life, and it's certainly one of the things that we deal with in analysis. People come to analysis in a way to do that, whether they know it or not. Second is the ordeal. The ordeal involves submitting to a process, often a painful process, that you can't control and you simply must endure. The third is the trial of strength, which is seen in the familiar pattern of heroic undertakings in our culture, whether they be athletic, emotional, or scholarly. You see people going through Marine boot camp or going to medical school or even something like a marriage to a young person who's frightened. These are challenging things that people do in spite of the resistance This form of initiation is associated with the father principle and being accepted as an adult in the society. Typical dreams of running in a race, being late to class, or unprepared for a test fall into this category. The Hopi Sun Dance has elements of both the trial of strength and an ordeal, as does the crucifixion of Jesus, which is the central image of religious initiation in Christianity. Finally, there is what Henderson calls the rite of vision. This is the fourth stage, which is an initiation into one's individuality at the most basic level. And this is seen primarily, at least in traditional societies, in shamanic rites. I think you will see the interweaving of these various patterns of initiation in the dream material that follows. I'll just outline them for you again and give you a rough schema, even though these occur, because of the way the unconscious works, these occur in various sequences. It's not a linear progression. But the first would be the return to the mother, which is a sense of getting something from the maternal or the womb of the unconscious that was missed out on. The second is the ordeal, which is actually an initiation into the group, whether it's Marine boot camp or fraternity hazing, or many other forms this takes in our culture, the initiation of priesthood. It's a group status that's achieved. And then moving from the group status to the status of being an adult is overseen, you could say, by the father principle, and that initiation is the trial of strength. You do something on your own, it's individual, you make your way in the world, you make your mark on the world. And then finally, that group adaptation and that collective adaptation which you've achieved, if you're the kind of person who has an inner need to do this, may be altered by a rite of vision, which in a shamanic society would mark you as an individual. You would both be of the group and separate from the group. So it provides a further step. There's a diagram in Thresholds of Initiation that Dr. Henderson has where he shows these as a stepwise ladder, but then as around it he has a circle, and what he's saying is that the circle in a sense represents shamanic initiation, which would encompass all of these, and it also could represent the analytic process. So these things don't have to happen one after the other, you know, going through first, second, third grade in that kind of a linear way. But it is useful to think of them that way, as stages of life. As we approach the clinical work I have prepared, I want to remind you that I have permission from the patient to discuss his dreams and our process, naturally having disguised the personal details. I ask you to hold with me the sacred nature of the dreams and their meaning, as it is in that spirit that I bring this very private material into a public arena. It was as though the unconscious took hold of both of us and revealed a process that moved between and beyond our waking egos. There is a hexagram in the I Ching which comes to mind when I reflect on this work. It's number 20, contemplation. A slight variation in tonal stress gives the Chinese name for this hexagram a double meaning. It means both contemplating and being seen, in the sense of being an example. The judgment, contemplation. The ablution has been made, but not yet the offering. Full of trust, they look to him. That's a quote from Wilhelm's translation of the I Ching. This attitude for the unfolding of a deep process without the burden of overanalysis while it is taking place is what I followed in this case. In patients who were neglected or traumatized in childhood, but who are highly intelligent and well-educated, too much attention to making meaning of the material may reinforce intellectual defenses against a deeper process. A number of years ago, I began to conceive of this kind of analysis as implicit work in the transference, in contrast to more explicit interpretation of interpersonal dynamics. Certainly, I was attending to the subtle cues in the hour, as well as dream images, which alluded to the personal field. But for the most part, I tried to foster a holding environment in which the patient's unconscious, in dialogue with his own ego and with me, was doing the work. As you will see from the dream process that took hold, there was ample confirmation that this approach was working. For the analyst, this creative holding may mean sacrificing the cloak of analytic certainty. But I think that if used judiciously, it may serve as a model for the patient to sink deeper into his own experience. Jung expressed a similar sentiment about the change in attitude he felt after his break with Freud. And as you know, when Jung was writing the Symbols of Transformation, which precipitated his break with Freud, he knew as he was writing it that it was costing him not only his friendship with Freud, but his central position in the whole psychoanalytic community. And he entitled the last chapter of this book, The Sacrifice. Reflecting on that change in his attitude years later, he wrote in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, quote, "Above all, I felt it necessary to develop a new attitude toward my patients. I resolved for the present not to bring any theoretical premises to bear on them, but to wait and see what they would tell me of their own accord. My aim became to leave things to chance." In regard to their dreams, he said, quote, "The interpretations seem to follow of their own accord from the patient's replies and associations. I avoided all theoretical points of view and simply helped the patients to understand the dream images by themselves." So this was a major break from the Freudian sexual or drive model in which the analyst knew in advance what the material meant. One can hear a similar maturational process in the work of the British psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott when he wrote late in his life, quote, "If only we can wait, the patient arrives at understanding creatively and with immense joy. And I now enjoy this joy more than I used to enjoy the sense of having been clever. I think I interpret mainly to let the patient know the limits of my understanding." End of quote. And that's from a paper of Winnicott's called On the Use of the Object. So far, I've emphasized a surrender on the part of the analyst, but is equally important for the patient when an initiatory process takes hold, a process which has at its core the archetype of death and rebirth. I've come to see that for surrender to be a transformative experience, there must be a letting go of a part or symbol of the self, which may be voluntary, as in some spiritual paths, or it may feel imposed by fate. In the material that follows, there is a sacrifice of the supremacy of the intellect and of a purely rational standpoint. In many Eastern traditions, surrender is seen as a path to awakening from an illusory world, a theme we shall see in the material as well. Heinrich Zimmer wrote, quote, "The primary concern of the East has always been not information, but transformation. A radical changing of man's nature, and a renovation both of the outer world and of his own experience." End of quote. The psychoanalyst Immanuel Gent suggests a similar distinction between analytic approaches, quote, "In the schism between analysts whose emphasis is informational, meaning insight is what cures, as against those for whom the focus is transformational, with cure comes insight." End of quote. If deeply felt surrender is to accomplish something resembling a cure, there must be a connection with some transpersonal factor in the psyche, by whatever name we call it. To accomplish this, the initiation archetype brings about a break from the old status of being, a rite of separation, which may feel like submission to an external authority or surrender to an internal process. The deeper transformative experience takes place in a liminal state, represented strikingly in the material that follows, as either a dream within a dream or a vision within a dream. And it may remain shrouded in mystery. Finally, the rite of reentry is often well defined and expressed symbolically as a return to ordinary human conditions. This kind of initiatory drama, unlike fixed religious or intellectual beliefs, which tend to be static and strongly held, involves a surrender to unknown processes of change and letting go. The archetypal images and energies are freed from religious dogma and express themselves in new and often startling ways that speak uniquely to this individual. And this is a really important point, because the images you're going to hear from the dreams about the crucifixion and the time between the crucifixion and resurrection and the healing of the Messiah are unique to this patient. And part of what was healing for him, and part of what enabled him to develop a religious attitude as an adult, was that this was no longer tied to dogma. He didn't have to take somebody else's word for it. It came to him directly. So I want to read to you a poem by David White. I don't know how many of you know his work, which struck me as a piece of creative work that goes right to the heart of this facing of death that is central to the initiation. This poem is called "Revelation Must Be Terrible." Revelation must be terrible with no time left to say goodbye. Imagine that moment, staring at the still waters, with only the brief tremor of your body to say you're leaving everything and everyone you know behind. Being far from home is hard, but you know at least we're all exiled together. When you open your eyes to the world, you are on your own for the first time. No one is even interested in saving you now, and the world steps in to test the calm fluidity of your body from moment to moment, as if it believed you could join its vibrant dance of fire and calmness and final stillness, as if you are meant to be exactly where you are, as if, like the dark branch of a desert river, you could flow on without a speck of guilt, and everything, everywhere, would still be just as it should be. As if your place in the world mattered, and the world could neither speak nor hear the fullness of its own bitter and beautiful cry without the deep well of your body resonating in the echo, knowing, knowing, knowing that it takes only that first terrible word to make the circle complete. Revelation must be terrible, knowing you can never hide your voice again. In the new foreword to Thresholds of Initiation, Henderson reflects that the heart of the book, quote, focuses on the first essential element of initiation, the ordeal. This stage is often painful and even messy. It has an element of surrender to it, end of quote. In the dreams that follow, we shall see the ordeal and the trial of strength in the form of the crucifixion, alternating with a return to the mother seen in the healing and maternal function of baptism. There is a tension between these two patterns, the ordeal and the trial of strength on one hand, and going down into the water on the other, which finally resolves in a third initiatory process, the rite of vision. I chose this case to demonstrate the psychological problem often seen in very bright people who bypass their emotions with a precocious development of the mind, a situation where the danger of too much interpretation and insight is to reinforce the intellectual defenses. The question then becomes one of finding other avenues to reveal hidden meaning, And in this case, the dreams provided powerful imagistic and emotional experiences of transformation. The patient came to analysis as a man in his late 40s to deal with chronic pain, marital and family conflicts, a tendency to overwork himself, and his own desire for personal growth. He had a long-standing interest in his dreams and some familiarity with Jungian psychology. But he also had a strong skepticism about New Age ideas, woolly thinking, and religious dogma of any sort. Chris grew up in an extremely poor family in the rural South. His father was a miner and a severe alcoholic who lost the family farm because of his drinking and had to go to work in the mines. In contrast to his father, Chris's mother was a strict Southern Baptist. The children suffered physical abuse from their father and severe neglect, getting scanty food, inadequate winter clothing, and poor medical and dental care. Chris was sheltered by his mother's religious beliefs until he was a teenager and he began to think for himself. Around the age of 12, he went through a crisis of faith and an adolescent depression. He put his reliance on his own emerging intellect and his desire to get away from his early family experience. He applied himself academically in high school and won a scholarship to the local state college, where he found new intellectual horizons and became part of a 1960s subculture. He was drafted from college and went to Vietnam. He finished college after getting out of the Army and worked at a number of manual jobs, ending up in San Francisco. A casual conversation with a friend about his lack of direction led to a referral for Jungian therapy. During the decade of that treatment, he got a well-paying job in the high-tech industry and married a Jewish woman from a middle-class family. Years later, and I mean many years later, when he came to me as a middle-aged man, he had been through a career change and was a licensed health professional. The early months of our work dealt with marital problems and a serious physical injury that required multiple surgeries and ongoing pain management. The tensions in his marriage had increased during the stressful time that he was out of work, recovering from a recent operation. Though admitting to me that he had thoughts of suicide, he claimed that he was not depressed. His suicidal ideation in his mind was very rational. The situation was unbearable and he could see no way out of it. After about 2 years of treatment, he was in a great deal of physical and emotional pain the first time he dreamed of the crucifixion. Subsequent dreams about Christ were often months apart, and interspersed with other powerful dreams about animals, initiation ordeals, and more personal material. This dream came as a total surprise to both of us and led to an emotional breakthrough in the session. The dream. By the way, some of these dreams I'm going to read twice because they're very, very dense and the images are so compact that it's hard to take in. And if there are others that as I go through them, you want to hear parts of them or hear more of this sort of wave or raise your hand. I can't read them all twice or we'd be here way too late, but this one is, I'll read again. Something about the crucifixion. I'm with a man, shorter, Greek-looking, like a portrait of Alexander the Great, behind billowy light blue curtains. We're on the backside of Golgotha, so we can see the backs of the crosses. The two crosses on either side are raised and set in place. For some reason, I think they're suffering less than Christ will suffer. The cross with Christ is raised, and the long vertical pole falls into the hole which has been dug for it. It's a terrible sound, and I imagine the pain in the places where the nails hold his body to the cross. The vertical pole makes a loud thud sound, and a groan goes up from the crowd. So let me read that again. Something about the crucifixion. I'm with a man, shorter, Greek-looking, like a portrait of Alexander the Great, behind billowy light blue curtains. We're on the backside of Golgotha, so we can see the backs of the crosses. The two crosses on either side are raised and set in place. For some reason, I think they're suffering less than Christ will suffer. The cross with Christ is raised, and the long vertical pole falls into the hole which has been dug for it. It is a terrible sound, and I imagine the pain in the places where the nails hold his body to the cross. The vertical pole makes a loud thud sound, and a groan goes up from the crowd. His association to Alexander was the heroic attitude. He realized that he'd been trying to keep up his life as though the pain would not interfere with it. He admitted, when he registered my wince upon hearing the dream, that he had been hiding the extent of his physical suffering from me. I told him that I could see it on his face at times, coming up the stairs and into my office. What I didn't tell him is that I felt sympathetic pain in my own body at times when he shifted awkwardly in the chair. He said that he was afraid that talking about it would only make it worse, but he did proceed to tell me about the nightly ice packs, the insomnia, and his memory of childhood sufferings that came in the wee hours of the morning. His wife had a lot of work-related travel, and he would lie there alone at night with the pain, thinking, "I have nobody." Then very slowly, and in a lot of pain, he said, "No body." After a silence, I repeated the question, "No body?" "Well," he said, "she's not there, and between the pain meds and the ice, I can get pretty numb." We both realized he was thawing out a bit, telling me this, giving in to suffering it consciously with me rather than alone. There were tears in the silence. The next dream of the Messiah was about a year and a half later. It seems that I'm in Jerusalem. It's the time between the crucifixion and the resurrection. The Messiah is recovering in someone's home. He's lying in bed, writhing in pain. Later, it seems, he's in a large walk-in bath. Someone says, "Messiah, you need to be careful of your wounds." He walks out of the tub. There's blood in the water. He touches the blood and crosses himself. I go over and touch a drop of the blood and do the same thing. He walks past a boy who's blind. His eyes are completely white. As the Messiah passes the boy, his eyes start slowly to develop beautiful blue pupils. The boy sees. Then it seems I'm on a stage talking to the audience about this story. All the while, Gorecki's Third Symphony is playing. The strains of the music are getting louder and louder. I wake up thinking, what is this? Chris realized that the boy was a part of himself who was blind to the healing mystery he was being shown in the dream. He hated the childlike attitude of religious thinking, which he said was just, quote, wish-fulfilling fantasy. It reminded him of his mother, but also of his wife's family and their New Age ideas. He remembered the fights he had had with his own mother when he quit the church, and he decided not to believe in anything he couldn't get for himself. The music was the most powerful part of the dream, he said, as though it contained all the emotion he wasn't feeling. There was a sense of awe. In spite of his intellectual bias against religious dogma, the dreams are showing Chris that his early experience of faith has some important meaning to him as an adult. Based on church tradition and ritual, Henderson writes that the time between the crucifixion and the ascension, quote, was essentially a return to the mother for the sake of rebirth, represented by the living water of the baptismal font. And here the Messiah is healing, and he's in the baptismal font. He's in this tub. It seems that the dream is restoring a basic childhood faith, something represented by his personal mother before he broke with the church, as well as by the archetypal mother deep in the psyche. This return to the mother is followed by an upwelling of masculine forces in the next dream. And I think we'll see this the way so many archetypal processes go, that you see one extreme and the other. Things move back and forth. The third dream. And by the way, there are many, many other dreams between these. These are nodal dreams that I've picked out. I'm watching a band of gorillas. The males are fighting over a harem. The females and the young are watching, trying to stay out of the way. The Messiah appears and sits among them. The gorillas stop fighting and return to eating. The Messiah says, "These are my faithful. They are content." In the distance, on a mountaintop, a wild storm suddenly appears. I can see the silhouettes of some gorillas grunting and dancing against the backdrop of the storm. One raises his arm as if to point. They all howl and dance. I look for the Messiah, but he is not here now. Chris was fascinated with evolutionary theory, especially the ongoing studies of the higher apes and recent discoveries in paleoanthropology. He had utter disdain for the creationist view of the Bible, which he had been taught growing up. He put his trust in science, so he felt a bit confused by the Messiah's strange words to these gorillas. "These are my faithful, they are content." The imagery was very vivid, moving, very real to him. He felt a sense of awe seeing the gorillas dance in the coming storm. I commented on the juxtaposition of nature and religious imagery, which he agreed was important. The fighting male gorillas with the backdrop of a wild storm suggests a thunder rite and shows the eruption of a strongly competitive masculine force in the psyche, mediated at least temporarily by the Messiah. A few months later, he dreamed of me. "I am with you. You are exasperated with me about Jesus. You say, 'Let go and get God.' I can't believe you're saying it. You're saying it about my mother-in-law. If you forgive her," you say, followed by something from one of the parables. I have this experience that the parable feels like bubbles going up into the sky. Then a voice is saying, "If you had the faith of a mustard seed." Later, I'm on a train going through the Swiss Alps, moving through beautiful vistas. The train stops. We all gaze at the wondrous peaks. Chris imagined that I didn't like his dreams about Jesus. He thought or knew that I was Jewish, and he suspected that I shared his negative attitude towards Christianity. But he himself was ambivalent, as he didn't like his Jewish mother-in-law's anti-Christian prejudice, and he held her fuzzy New Age thinking in contempt. He hoped I wasn't supporting, quote, "that kind of shit." He made jokes with me about his friends, one of whom was always talking about the Buddha, and a friend of his wife who was into the goddess. I gestured to a statue of Kuan Yin sitting by his elbow on the windowsill, a statue I have in my office. He laughed uneasily and said, "Oh, that's just Jungian stuff." "Really?" I said, and we both had a good laugh. He went on to the parable of the mustard seed, citing the passage as Luke 16, which I later found out was actually Luke 61. He had reversed the numbers, but he knows his Bible. And he joked that I probably didn't know the Bible as well as he. I agree that I didn't know the exact reference. He went on to say that the vistas in the Alps were something he could see with his own eyes. He knew that I loved the mountains, and he felt a real connection with me about them. We had shared some backpacking stories and nature things. He was a very strong, big, strapping guy who had done a lot of outdoor work before this physical problem prevented it. And I think part of what was coming up in the the gorilla dream was this competitive masculine side of him, and then the dream about what I said, presumably that I don't like his dreams about Jesus, is sort of polarizing this tension. You know, how are we going to work out this mano a mano thing between us? But he did remember that I liked the mountains, and we shared that. And he said, and this really, really struck me in a deep way, because I thought it was the first glimpse he had of the reality of the psyche. He said that the dreams were just as much a fact of nature, that they were his direct experience. He wasn't sure what they meant, and sometimes he wanted to hear more of what I thought about them, but basically he was glad I didn't try too hard to interpret them. I silently wondered if the appearance of the Messiah might help him to heal the split between his childhood faith and his adult skepticism. I also considered that the words said by me in the dream, "let go and get God," suggested a fear on his part that I wanted him to surrender directly to God. Could it be, I was thinking, that God was too abstract and impersonal an object of his surrender, perhaps too dangerous? After all, he knew the book of Job as well as he knew the parables. Given the severity of his negative father wound, it seemed likely that he needed a human intercessor, someone more personal and closer to his experience, the Messiah who appears as an image of the wounded healer. 8 months later came a longer dream, which I'll summarize in part. Chris walked into the office with a dream paper in hand, gave it to me with a shrug, and said, laughing, "What's a modern Christian to do? Why do I keep getting dreams like this?" This dream takes place in Europe, in the ruins of a beautiful church, in the forest. There are parts of walls and stained glass window, lots of blue, a road leading deeper into the forest. Quote, "I hear a group singing the old gospel song, The Golden Crown. As I went down to the river to pray, studying about the good old way, and who will wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down to the river to pray." So you see, we're going back down now to the water, to the baptism, to the mother. Later, I'm above the tree lines in the mountains. The road has gotten very steep and rocky as I go uphill. I look back, and there's nothing but steep road behind me. There are spots of blood on it ahead of me. My back hurts so much that I want to lie down by the side of the road. I want my back to sink into the road. I watch the clouds drift by. Up the hill further, I can hear noise. There's a public execution going on. Then I get hot and sweaty, and I realize it's the crucifixion. There are groans and awful noises. Then it's all quiet. It's actually so quiet that I'm awakened by the quiet. The Golden Crown was a hymn that he loved as a child, and he enjoyed the scene where it was sung in the recent film, O Brother, Where Art Thou? Yet the shift to the hard climb, the pain, the blood, and another dream about the crucifixion was another matter. I felt struck by the feeling quality of the hymn, with its images of descent to the river and his positive childhood memories, in contrast to the difficult climb, a sort of trial of strength leading to yet another image of the ordeal. So you can see here the balance between the return to the mother, the baptism, the healing imagery of that, and then the ordeal and the trial of strength. He said, I know I'm hurting, so why do I need dreams like this? He knows about Jung's idea that dreams compensating the conscious attitude. It's really hard stuff to deal with. The time was up, and I had no ready answer. It was an awkward moment between us, a silence not unlike the quiet that awakened him at the end of the dream. I thought after the session that this quietude had the effect of a Zen koan, stopping not only his mind, but mine as well. But as we shall see, that silencing of the mind did lead to something new, awakening in the psyche. Within a week came two very powerful initiation dreams, one more spiritual and the other purely instinctual. The initial one anticipates the more visionary experiences that follow. Remember, I told you, as this tension builds between the dreams of baptism and the dreams of the ordeal and trial of strength, that finally something begins to break through of the visionary initiation. And I think you'll see that in what's to come. And those visionary dreams appear as either dreams within a dream or visions within a dream. This is the next dream. I'm lying on the ground near my old cabin in the woods. I fall asleep by the creek and start to dream, knowing I'm dreaming. In the dream, I've just finished up my business in the outhouse, and I'm looking at the beautiful view of the mountains off in the distance. I wonder if I'll wake up in the dream and write down what I'm dreaming. Later, I walk past the cabin through the forest to where I see another house above the creek. As I get closer, I see it's a castle. As I get closer, I realize it's Jung's castle and he's inside. I walk around to the entrance and he's sitting in a chair reading with his glasses partway down his nose, looking a little silly. We both laugh, as he knows he looks silly. It seems like we talk for a long time. I want to ask him if he was really a Christian, but before I do, he says something about Christ that I don't understand. At the same time, I can feel his answer. It's something like, "We are what we are." But it's not in words or sentences. I struggle with his answer because I know what it is, but I can't say it. It's something like symbolic feeling. He puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "It'll be all right." I want to ask him more questions, especially about evolution. He looks at me intensely with his eyes ablaze. He seems to be saying in the same fashion, that is, without words, "That is your problem." Then he says he has to go. Later, I'm walking back through the forest to my cabin. When I look back, the castle isn't there anymore. Then I'm lying on the ground near the creek, and my old girlfriend Meg is waking me up. "We could hear you snoring all the way up the hill," she says. Then we take off our clothes and go for a dip in the creek. As I'm getting out of the water, I look across the meadow at Black Dog Peak. The sky is bright with color, though it's the middle of the day. Then I really wake up. Should I read this dream again? This is a very compact dream. It's sort of a breakthrough dream. I'm lying on the ground near my old cabin in the woods. I fall asleep by the creek and start to dream, knowing I'm dreaming. In the dream, I've just finished up in the outhouse, and I'm looking at the beautiful view of the mountains off in the distance. I'm wondering if I'll wake up in the dream and write down what I'm dreaming. Later, I walk past the cabin, through the forest, to where I see another house above the creek. As I get closer, I see it's a castle with a light in one of the windows. A bit strange, I think. As I get closer, I realize it's Jung's castle, and he's inside. I walk around to the entrance, and he's sitting in a chair reading, with his glasses partway down his nose, looking a little silly. We both laugh, as he knows he looks silly. It seems like we talk for a long time. I want to ask him if he was really a Christian, but before I do, he says something about Christ that I don't understand. At the same time, I can feel his answer, something like, "We are what we are." But it's not in words or sentences. I struggle with his answer because I know what it is, but I can't say it. It's symbolic feeling. He puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "It will be all right." I want to ask him more questions, especially about evolution. He looks at me intensely with his eyes ablaze. He seems to be saying in the same fashion, that is, without words, "That is your problem." Then he says he has to go. Later, I'm walking back through the forest to my cabin. When I look back, the castle isn't there anymore. Then I'm lying on the ground near the creek, and my old girlfriend Meg is waking me up. "We could hear you snoring all the way up the hill," she says. Then we take off our clothes and go for a dip in the creek. As I'm getting out of the water, I look across the meadow at Black Dog Peak. The sky is bright with color, though it's the middle of the day. Then I really wake up. Chris wished he could remember and understand what Jung had said about Christ. He knew he was dreaming, so he thought he could be more conscious about what happened. He said it was like the Grail Castle, a place where you could find out what the truth was. I pointed it out that it might be seen as an initiation dream, and that the outhouse and the snoring at the end grounded him in ordinary reality, that they are markers of his being a natural man. It seemed to me that they were like rites of entering and exiting a deeper imaginal realm. He agreed with this and said he liked it that Jung could laugh at himself. I was aware of the warmth and the felt sense of connection that had developed between us during our work, and that his sense of humor helped him to keep a better perspective on the serious pain he still suffered, as well as on the potential inflation that was coming with these dreams. He could laugh at himself. I never knew if he associated the dream Jung with me at a conscious level, but I didn't raise the question. What I did ask was what he meant when he said it was, quote, symbolic feeling. He answered that it was pre-logical, like knowing something directly without knowing how you knew it. That kind of knowing felt good, just like the dip in the creek after he woke up. The color was very moving, he said, like dawn or sunset, but in the middle of the day. He was very moved by how real it was. And this is a little like the early dream with Gorecki's Third Symphony, where the emotion is carried in the senses. In that dream, it was the music, and here it's the color. It occurred to me that for a man with such a terrible father history, Chris had come a long way in accepting help from male authority figures. He had had earlier dreams of Eisenhower, FDR, and Churchill, and it seemed to me that Jung was a logical inner father to help him in the process of finding the right psychological balance between the scientific and religious attitudes. Jung's responses reminded me of a Zen master who points the student to his own experience rather than trying to provide logical explanations. "We are what we are" is something like a Zen koan. And his answer about evolution puts the process of evolution right back where it belongs, inside Chris. I thought of Jung's visions in his own near-death experience when he was about to enter the rock temple, when he too sought answers to the ultimate questions about his life, but he was turned back to the direct experience. Chris's cabin reminds me of the initiation hut in shamanic cultures. Henderson writes about the rites of purification that lead from the public ceremonies of the shaman to the individual vision. Quote, "The little hut thus serves the function of providing a transitional stage of containment between the purificatory rite and the transforming encounter with the animal." End of quote. Having bathed himself in the creek after his individual meeting with Jung as master of initiation, Chris is ready for the animal encounters which follows. The next dream seems important as an instinctual compensation for the spiritual encounter of the Grail Castle. And remember, I said there were two dreams within the next week that both seemed to me like initiation dreams. I'm on a high desert plain overlooking a plateau in an ancient time. As I look down over a series of valleys, I see great herds of deer or reindeer surging through the valleys. I notice some of the animals are white, but only a few. Their antlers are different too. They glow with color. As the herds come together and drift apart, the white deer move into different positions, all done in a synchronized way, purely instinctual. The herd probably unaware it is taking place. It's so rhythmic, hypnotic, beautiful. Then suddenly men, Cro-Magnon men I know, jump out of the bushes and rocks and bring down a deer. It is very intense. The weapons are not as advanced as you'd think, so they have to get much closer, and it's much more violent. One of the men with a short spear finally gets it into the deer. The deer goes down on its front knees and makes a pitiful noise. Then it's over. The men are eating the liver raw. There is blood everywhere, on them, on the ground, everywhere. I start to get sick. I wake up feeling I'm going to vomit. His only comment on this dream was, "I guess you have to eat to live." My thought was that he was having to surrender to his own aggression as well as to his religious impulses. At the time of early Christianity, Roman soldiers were attracted to the Mithraic mysteries, whose central symbol was a man with a knife slaying a bull. Chris's animal encounter takes the form of recognizing the primitive need to kill in order to survive, the very opposite of the surrender symbolized by the crucifixion. Sometime after his dream about Jung's castle, I noticed that he was capitalizing the pronoun he in the typewritten dreams when Jesus appeared, but neither one of us said anything about it. You know what, do we need a break now? I know this would be a good time for a break, and then we'll pick it up. I'll review what I've just covered, and we'll pick it up again. And it sort of fits with how taxing, I know this material is fascinating. It's also taxing to listen to it and take it in. So anyway, this is what Hafez says in a poem called "A Cushion for Your Head." Just sit there right now. Don't do a thing. Just rest. For your separation from God, from love, is the hardest work in this world. Let me bring you trays of food and something that you like to drink. You can use my soft words as a cushion for your head. So that's for our break. All right, so just to backtrack a little bit, I told you this dream of I have to remember myself. The dream of going down to the water, the dream of the hymn of Golden Crown, "O sisters, let's go down," that then changes to this hard, difficult climb and another experience of the crucifixion. And that dream ends with this intense quiet, and he's awakened by the quiet. I think that dream and the quieting of the mind in that dream laid the groundwork for these two very powerful initiation dreams that occurred within a week. And the first one was the Grail Castle, which in the dream is Jung's castle, but his association is the Grail Castle. And then the second one is this very visceral animal dream that takes place in sort of proto-human Cro-Magnon time. So it sort of opened the way for this holding of these two aspects of the psyche, one of which, and in Edinger's book, Ego and Archetype, he has a chapter on the blood of Christ, and he talks about various stages of sacrifice. And one is man sacrifices man to God, and that's the Christian sacrifice. But another is man sacrifices an animal to God, which is the Mithraic sacrifice. It's Abraham sacrificing the ram. And that is the ancient sacrifice, which represented humanity sacrificing instinctual drives to arrive at a higher stage of development. So I think what you can see here is that these different forces are in play in the psyche now. There are very powerful instinctual drives, and there are a lot of animal dreams that I couldn't include just because of the length of the talk, but there was a whole series of bear dreams, and in some of them the bear was very aggressive, and in some it was very playful, and in some it was clearly a master of initiation. And there's that gorilla dream with the male gorillas fighting, and the Messiah brings peace to that. So now we have this dream in which the human attacks and kills a deer and sacrifices it. So these forces within the psyche are going back and forth, and there's some tension, which I think what we're beginning to see is that the visionary quality opens up within the dreams, and that these visions will take up elements of those other two forms of initiation into the actual visions. So that's sort of where we are. Any question about that? I know that's a complicated thought. So, so I commented on the fact that after the Grail, the Jung's castle dream, he started capitalizing he when he referred to the Messiah or to Jesus. Neither one of us commented on it. There's another long dream within a dream, and from here on out, a lot of the dreams I'm going to be telling you have that dream within a dream quality. In this one, he's riding on a train in the Southwest, and he falls asleep on the train and dreams of the Messiah healing from his wounds. And this is in the dream within a dream. As Christ walks past the people on the train, everyone is changed for the better. As I, the dreamer, wake up, there is an old Hank Williams song playing on the train. And that's a longer dream that I summarized. A few months later, he dreamed that he was traveling down the Nile River in Egypt when the boat captain warns those passengers on the ship that there are live crocodiles in the river. Chris falls asleep on a deck chair and dreams that someone is bringing in the container of several scraps of metal. Quote, at the bottom of the bucket, there's a crucifix and a figure of Christ bleeding on the cross. His hands are bleeding and so are his feet. I touch the blood and think it's holy. Jesus wept, I hear someone say. For some reason, I say, it's the shortest verse in the Bible. It dawns on me as I dream that this is no ordinary boat. It is on a mythical Nile River, which is a river of dreams. I'm unclear about its meaning, I say, but it's something about traveling on a river that still has man-devouring beasts. It's unlike real life, because in real life, it's the buildings and cars and pollution and sawmills and mines that are devouring men. Later, I realize I've been I realize that the person that I've been talking with will ask me to interpret their dreams when we are awakened again. The boat pulls into Corinth, where we are going to look at temples. Chris was struck by the fact that once again the deeper meaning was carried by the dream within a dream, and he wanted to know what I thought of that. I said he seemed to be relaxing in the dream, falling asleep on the deck chair, in spite of the danger of crocodiles in the river, and that it represented a deeper surrender of conscious control. He wondered about the fact that the person he was talking with will ask for a dream interpretation from him. I asked him if he thought it might be me, and he said, "Well, you always ask me what comes to mind when I tell the dreams to you." It seemed as if something of our dialogue might be getting incorporated into the dreams. But in a more significant way, this dream may have been anticipating his need to leave the container of analysis and to find his own way with the unconscious. And I think this is where you begin to see the inner analyst at work, that something of the process is getting internalized. The next dream about Jesus came at the height of a struggle about the way his dislike of organized religion affected his attitude towards his Jewish in-laws. After the recent death of his father-in-law, Chris wanted to be supportive of his wife and respectful of her family's period of mourning. But he was annoyed by his mother-in-law's New Age attitude towards things, and particularly a comment she made about being reunited with her husband in heaven, which, by the way, is not particularly Jewish. He made the sarcastic comment, not to mention the family dog. It genuinely pained him to feel like an outsider with her relatives because he disliked their beliefs. Yet he had said the Kaddish with them at the gravesite, and he was very moved by the experience. In the dream, Chris leaves his wife on the sidewalk in New York. Her family was from New York, and he had just been back for the funeral. So he leaves his wife on the sidewalk after expressing disgust with a religious-looking older Jewish couple. He says something about he notices that the woman is wearing a wig and probably has a shaved head, and his wife says, "Yes, they're Orthodox," and he goes, "Harumph." So he makes some sort of just general sound of disgust. He leaves his wife and goes alone into a library that is built in the shape of the Getty Museum, a spiral shape. Trying to take the elevator up to the 12th floor, instead, he is carried by the elevator down to a church in the basement of this library. Here he finds Jesus in one of the pews, and he kneels to pray with him. Jesus has dark curly hair and is very Jewish looking. He is holding a rosary in his hands, but the prayer he prays is the Kaddish. As he goes through the Kaddish, he is going through the rosary beads. Then he says something to me about David. I realize that the old Jewish couple I saw on the sidewalk was David and somebody, he doesn't know who. He gets up, and I see that he's undergone the crucifixion. I say, "Messiah, you must be careful." He walks past a young boy who is sleeping on the benches. The young boy wakes up cheerful and follows Jesus. He goes to the elevator, and I follow him in. He pushes 12. I wake up. I woke from the dream confused, not knowing which way is up. Literally, he goes in the elevator and pushes 12, thinking he's going to go up, and the elevator takes him down, and then they get in the basement elevator, and it takes them up. So there's this which way is up quality to the dream. The name David reminded him of King David, who he said is the one who gets away with everything in the Bible, and God still loves him. Now, what we worked with on this was his guilt over his animosity towards his relatives, that he could have his feelings and he could still be loved by God. He said David could do no wrong. Jesus is from the house of David, but he is humble in how he suffers. And then he remembers sleeping on the back pew of the church when he was a boy, and how this young boy who follows Jesus so cheerfully is so different than the way he felt as an older child anyway. 12 is like a complete cycle of time, and it feels as if something is coming full circle now. It was at age 12 that I went through the worst crisis of faith. After that, I decided I had to make it on my own, and that I wasn't ever going to rely on anything I couldn't see or touch or think for myself. It's been changing lately, and I have a new feeling about it all, about the dreams, about this work. My life isn't so stuck. He went on to say that he was reading Jack Miles' biography of Christ, and he realized that there was a more symbolic level of meaning to the story. He said he was sure there was some reason he was being given these dreams and that it might take him the rest of his life to understand them. I agreed that they were extremely important dreams, and I added that whatever they meant to him over time, his attitude towards them had certainly changed. This dream of Jesus saying Kaddish is laden with archetypal symbols. Let me say briefly that the central theme is the reconciliation of opposites. Jewish-Christian, up-down, age-youth, skepticism-belief, and the vertical and circular images of initiation which resolve into a spiral. Also the library and the church in the basement of the library. So this is really a self-symbol. And there's a wonderful passage in another book by Joe Henderson, his book on cultural attitudes, where he talks about near the end of a deep analysis when initiation is taking hold, there are cultural symbols that unite opposite tendencies within the culture, but in a very specific and unique way to that individual. And I think this is that kind of dream. Chris has taken to heart the advice that Jung gave him in the Grail Castle in response to his question about evolution. As you may recall, Jung replied, "That is your problem." What was an intellectual interest for Chris, a scientific problem to be investigated, has now taken on an inner symbolic meaning. The spiral-shaped library with the church in the basement is a cultural symbol uniting the desire for learning with a religious attitude, as well as an indication that the initiation process is both vertical and cyclical. Or put another way, the maturation of consciousness involves movements back as well as forward in time. Henderson writes, quote, "In contrast to the stepladder or evolutionary view of initiation, our material has shown a distinctly cyclical character in which a return to old patterns is of no less significance than a sense of progression to new ones." End of quote. The next and final dream of Christ, which came 4 months later, recapitulates old themes of submission as baptism, the trial of strength, the threat of an ordeal, and finally, a new and more profound visionary experience. The dream begins with Chris swimming in a warm pool of clear, delightful water, water the color of air. The scene changes. Later, it seems to me I'm on a journey on a road in high desert country. I'm following a procession of some sort. Up ahead, someone says, "This is Emmaus Road." I hear a whip crack in the air. Maybe someone is being whipped. I'm scared. The thought of being whipped is terrifying. Then I realize that everyone who takes this road sees a vision of Christ. It doesn't matter who you are or what you're doing. Up ahead, at a specific place, everyone in the procession falls into a trance. They seem to stop. You can hear them speaking in tongues, some weeping and some laughing. I walk to that specific place and hear something. Then it seems that I'm further down the road. I turn back and look. I'm amazed that it happened so fast. Then it seems I'm speaking in tongues with someone. We talk for a long time, and then I step to the side of the road and into a modern building. Patients are waiting in the waiting room. I think, what the heck was that? Now I'm in the swimming pool again, this time nude. The water is soft, luxurious, relaxing, and healing. I hear someone say, "This is heaven." For a moment, it seems like they said it in tongues. At the shallow end, the minister is baptizing people. He too is speaking in tongues. I get in line. Later, I'm back near my cabin, swimming in the creek. It's a warm summer day, and I feel I've come home. Should I read this again? This one is a lot. So it starts out with him swimming in a bathing suit in this warm, delightful water. Later, I'm on a journey on a road in high desert country. I'm following a procession of some sort. Up ahead, someone says, "This is Emmaus Road." I hear a whip crack in the air. Maybe someone is being whipped. I'm scared. The thought of being whipped is terrifying. Then I realize that everyone who takes this road sees a vision of Christ. It doesn't matter who you are or what you're doing. Up ahead, at a specific place, everyone in the procession falls into a trance. They seem to stop. You can hear them speaking in tongues, some weeping and some laughing. I walk to that specific place and hear something. Then it seems that I'm further down the road. I turn back and look. I'm amazed that it happened so fast. Then it seems that I'm speaking in tongues with someone. We talk for a long time. And then I step to the side of the road and into a modern building. Patients are waiting in the waiting room. I think, what the heck was that? I'm swimming in the pool again, this time nude. The water is soft, luxurious, relaxing, and healing. I hear someone say, "This is heaven." For a moment, it seems like they said it in tongues. At the shallow end, the minister is baptizing people. He is also speaking in tongues. I get in line. Later, I'm back near my cabin, swimming in the creek. It's a warm summer day, and I feel I've come home. His associations included the fact that he had, in fact, suffered abuse at the hands of his father, and that he had heard speaking in tongues in the church of his youth. He said he had almost fallen into that trance once as a child. He knew consciously that Emmaus Road is the road to Damascus, where the conversion of Paul took place. Saul was the skeptic who later became a believer. And Chris mused out loud, really free associating in the hour for the first time, wondering if there was really an inner place where everyone can have a vision, where everyone heard and spoke a different language. I was really struck by the way he was letting go to a stream of inner ideas and images, settling into a deeper place in himself. Apropos of this stream of consciousness, let me add that he had been writing poetry for some time, but it was during this period that he began to get some things published. Chris had been struggling to make a decision whether or not to have another surgery to correct the problem from one of the previous operations. He had been getting conflicting opinions from various specialists about what to do. He was coming to the realization that there was no clear scientific answer and that he didn't know whom to trust, when he had a powerful dream which helped him to decide to go ahead with it. In other words, instead of looking for a scientific answer, he was looking to his own inner material. He would need to take time off from the work again and told me he was thinking of leaving analysis. He wanted to rest and heal after the operation, work on his poetry, and have more time with his family. particularly a new grandchild. He also thought about how to work on, that he wanted to work on the dreams on his own. A few weeks later, he had a different type of dream, one that points to the connection between Christianity and alchemy. I'm watching an ancient Egyptian woman standing in a partly framed house, 2x4 studs, no sheetrock, no walls. She is dressed in a floor-length white linen dress, outlined with sparkling gold. Her face and eyes are outlined with gold as well. Then I see that she is peeing. The curious thing is that as she's peeing, I see that she has a penis. The penis is sparkling gold as well. Then I say, "Hey." She turns and pees towards me, but she's too far to reach me. Her penis is very golden, very sparkling. In another possibility, everything in the dream is the same, but her dress is black, outlined by gold. The Egyptian woman reminded him of the dream of going down the Nile, and he felt like she was some presence from the past or from another dimension in the new house under construction. He liked the aesthetics of seeing her dress in white and gold, then black and gold. I commented that Egypt was the birthplace of Western alchemy. Jung comments in The Psychology of the Transference that the hermaphrodite often appears at the beginning, not at the end of a process. I think that Chris's decision to leave analysis may well echo T.S. Eliot's lines from the Four Quartets, quote, "In my end is my beginning," end of quote. Henderson comments on the compactness of image and brevity of statement that he's noticed in the dreams of people who are approaching the end of analysis, when individuation has become a way of life. We did follow Chris's material closely to see what the psyche had to say about his decision to end our work. He dreamed of a beautiful woman offering him a red apple from which she had already taken a bite. Through her small bite in the apple, he could see into another world, teeming with life. He hesitated and then bit into it. In a subsequent dream, he comes to the end of an arduous journey with an old African chief, perhaps a shaman, who gives him a special gift when it is time for him to go on alone. Traveling ahead on his own, he meets a young boy who has a message for him. The message is, "Through Christ our Lord." In a final dream, he is in a beautiful southwest canyon and sees a herd of wild mustangs race by. Later, a single horseman rides up to his campfire. The old cowboy's face is wrinkled with age and battle-scarred. As he rears his horse in the sunset, he waves his cowboy hat in a gesture of goodbye. He is magnificent, glowing with life. Chris gulps and starts to cry as he waves back. End of dream. It seemed to both of us that he was on the right track, and he set a date for ending. Along the lines of this last dream of the old cowboy hero, I want to share one of Chris's poems to give you a sense of the creative process that he was involved in consciously. "I'd kill you myself," my father said, "if I thought you were a communist. It was a tough town. Not much mercy in the hardcore, the slag piles, the settling ponds. Scarred earth where men and animals and machines had tunneled and dug and hauled and ground and smelt for 100 years. The richest hill on earth, the sign said. The New York bosses got the oysters, the men said. The men? They got weekly paychecks and hundreds of bars to drown their appetites. Sundays, Christians taught roots. Magnetic faith. Turn the other cheek. What does it profit a man? Mystifying, save in the chords of the hymn, Jesus calling softly and tenderly, for you and me. The Newsies had another song, "Let Me Get Me Behind Thee." Like the bosses, the chief of police had special techniques. Afraid, we peddled our papers around the corner, at the bottoms-up bar, the turf, the Elks, and hundreds of bar stools where liquid communion kept the men from agony in the devil's DTs. Weekend country western bands sang, "Take me as I am, or let me go." It has now been 3 years since Chris ended his 12 years of analysis with me. I did contact him to ask permission to use this material, and he was quite interested and excited to learn more what I've been thinking about it. He also told me that he's continued to follow his current material and to work on the major dreams about Christ, most recently stimulated by his reading of early Christian Gnosticism. He continues to write poetry and to integrate his inner process with his outer life without the help of analysis. At the end of the vision seminars, Jung writes, quote, "If we had followed up our case, we would have seen the gradual readjustment of the patient to a definite external reality in which the whole experience of the unconscious had to be fitted. As a rule, the world of inner images recedes and assumes again that remote and often invisible place, which it held before it had burst forth under the pressure of seemingly insoluble problems. First, it was like an inundation, and when the waters receded, they left a fertile deposit in which life could thrive. Such an experience of the unconscious leaves, if nothing else, a definite an everlasting mark upon the inner man, an awareness of the deep recesses of the soul which never vanishes." End of quote. From what I know of Chris, the outer man was permanently changed as well. So if there are any comments or questions, I think we have a minute.
So this feminine side, the anima or whatever, didn't really show up till the end?
The what?
The anima.
Oh, no, 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 no. She was there. She was there in a more personal way. But I think something was shifting at the archetypal level in that dream. But yeah, there were plenty of dreams with women. I just didn't, you know, I was sort of focusing on one line of development. But I think that was, what you're picking up on is true, that woman at the end, she wasn't really an anima figure in a sense because she was a hermaphrodite. But that powerful archetype. Yes, I think that's true. I think he was accepting, and I think that was mirrored in the poetry and in the ability to go more into a stream of associations in the hour. Yeah, something did get loosened up by that. Well, it just seemed to me that it these dreams had become consciously luminous to him, that he was accepting something of the profound. I mean, it's almost like, you know, in Jungian literature, when the self is capital S versus when it's little s. I think he was saying unconsciously it had taken on that power. Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
I'm curious about the huge disparity between this conscious rejection of religion and the death of religion in dreams.
Yeah. Well, I think the short answer is it says something about the compensatory function of the psyche, that he very much needed a religious attitude to cope with the physical pain and the life circumstances he was in, and he had the basis in his childhood for that. But I agree, there was this enormous tension between the conscious skepticism and the power of the images. You know, and he would make jokes about, oh, why am I getting dreams like this? He didn't want them. I mean, there are people who give their eye teeth for dreams like this, and they probably don't get them. I think so. I haven't seen him since he had that additional surgery, but I know in the time towards the end of our work together, he seemed to be, he was a very physical person, and one of the dilemmas he had was that he was limited and likes to travel, he likes to hike, there are all sorts of things that he had been very limited in, and he seemed to be doing more of those things. He didn't talk about it a lot. There was something very stoic about him, so I didn't... I think it was mixed, yeah. I think there's a mix of what was going on physically, and actually have a patient who had a, a knee replacement from an old accident and then ended up, the first time it was done, it wasn't done properly. It had to be redone 6 months later, and she ended up addicted to Vicodin and went through a pain a detox program, pain management program. And some of the new research on it is fascinating about how much of it is memory of pain. That there's a habituation of those tracts in the spinal column and cord and brainstem. And it's been remarkable to see how well she's been doing one. They take you off everything and put you on a long-acting morphine and then taper it down. And there's a lot of new research coming out on that. And I think probably in his case, he was in a situation where the adult trauma had reactivated early trauma. He went through a lot of serious dental pain as a kid. They just didn't have money for dentists, so when he'd have a tooth decay, and it'd be like, no root canal, no extraction, no nothing. They just wait for the tooth to die and then yank it. He said his mother had given him a cotton ball soaked in alcohol and aspirin. That was how they dealt with it. So, I mean, that kind of deprivation and pain. And I think the misery of all of that was, you know, repressed and split off, and the current situation brought a lot of that up. And I didn't go into it, but we reworked a lot of those memories. A lot of that came up as well. You know, I was focusing for this more on the archetypal level of it.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.